I think there's still very much this thing where most people don't think this is a thing that's going to happen.
Yeah, saying that it's not going to work is the same as going back to, you know, 1995 and saying that you're never going to be able to stream video on the internet.
The best case scenario for this rollout is they go on June 1st. There's no driver behind the wheel and the service area is bigger than Waymo's. The Tesla story has always been a story of derivatives. It's always been a story of acceleration, a story of like pace of improvement, pace of innovation. So Robotaxi, Tesla just put out a post that on June 1st, they said June 1st was what, 31 days away. This was yesterday or the day before. So it looks like the company's actually going to launch it on the 1st and not the end of June, maybe. Who knows? How are you reading that?
Yeah, I mean, I have heard that that's the goal is the 1st, which then people are like, well, so hopefully that means they'll actually get it out by the 31st of June. And, you know, I don't know if there will be a delay or not. What yeah. I do feel like, just my spider senses, based on all the commentary that I'm hearing from a variety of sources, is that we have the type of excitement and confidence from the Tesla team right now that reminds me of when they were telling us what all was coming in version 12. Like,
yeah.
Hey, we're gonna, you know, in October we're gonna launch this, and this. Mm-hmm. And people are like, there's no way they can ship all those things, and then they delivered on everything on that list. Yeah. That's the general vibe that I'm getting from the team. And the other thing to remember is going into that, it just felt like nothing was happening. It was like, we haven't had an update in forever. You know, it's like, we know version 12 is out, but, you know, most users haven't gotten it and it's meh, like it's good, it's better, but like we haven't had any updates. And it just kind of felt like we were in this weird limbo. And I think it felt like that because the team was hard at work on stuff that they were saving essentially for the 1010 event. And so You need the event in order to allow everyone to really see the fruit of all of that work and all that labor. And that's, you know, we haven't had a whole lot of version 13 updates here recently.
Yeah.
And I think that
it's been like kind 6 months, been a similar, right? From the last major release. 4 months,
maybe not six. Yeah, since yeah. like 13.2 started Eight. Rolling out.
Yeah,
because we've been on various versions of 13.2 now for quite a while. That's just like that's what it feels like. And we also heard Elon say that they're going to launch the service with like 10 to 20 cars on the first day and monitor it closely and then ramp up from there. And I think that is sandbagging a little, like he's deliberately trying to set expectations pretty low.
Which is a shocker for him.
I know. Yeah. Very, very crazy. But also, you know, there are things that involve safety that he really does focus on. Like, you know, if you've ever heard him talk about the first time they launched Bob and Doug on the Demo 1 mission for SpaceX, just like the amount of intensity that he had around the safety of the crew was next level. And I think that he's going to have the same type of intensity with regards to the safety of the Robotaxi network as well with the Model Ys that are coming out. So
if I can jump in there for a second, Hans, then does that imply no safety drivers then when they launch? Because I know Texas doesn't require, so this is something I learned a week or two ago. Texas does not require a safety driver for an autonomous vehicle. It's like what California does, Texas mm-hmm. doesn't. Texas kind of gives the company the benefit of the doubt. And then if something happens, then that's when the hammer comes down. So, I mean, so those two things combined, if they're taking this, you know, this quote unquote long to send an update through the fleet, and then Texas has the regulation that says you don't have to have a safety driver. I mean, if they really launch Model Y on the first without a safety driver, I think that's going to surprise a lot of people.
If you're only launching 10 to 20 vehicles, it certainly doesn't seem like you would compress the size of that launch day fleet that small if you were going to have safety drivers to back it up. Like so between that, I mean, it's not impossible. Like there's a number of options that are available to Tesla, and they're going to have to decide, you know, what optics they want, what technical challenges they want. But when you talk about having remote operators, that implies if you have a remote operator, then you don't have, like, you don't need a remote operator and a safety driver present in the vehicle at the same time. That's redundant and silly. So if you've got remote operators and you're just going to watch 10 to 20 vehicles like a hawk, that tells me that there's no safety driver in the vehicle. I think that's overwhelmingly the most likely scenario. And I think that does also, like, if you want to go head to head with Waymo, but you launch with safety drivers, then you give the opposition, you know, a lot of room to say, well, it's not the same. Yeah. And so I think from those reasons. Yeah, exactly. That's what I think is going to happen most likely. And I could definitely be proven wrong, but that's what I'm expecting.
So I just ran a poll, literally as we're recording this, I ran a poll on X, and usually these polls, we can get a good sense of it within the first 10 minutes because the data that comes in, you have enough of a sample size where the first 10 minutes of the poll is going to tell you how the poll is going to end, unless it gets brigaded.
It's representative of your audience specifically.
Yes, exactly.
Pretty quickly. Yeah.
Hans is a statistics expert. Didn't you know this? I love it. Okay, so I launched it a minute ago. We'll give it some time there. Because I think, you know, initially for me, all those variables make so much sense. I'm guessing the other Tesla channels you've been on have discussed this thoroughly. Are they all on the same page that it's going to be without a safety driver? Or is it a topic that hasn't been hit?
So we haven't really talked about it on Tesla Owners of Silicon Valley channel much.
Go check them out.
I've talked about it with Herbert a few times. And I think Herbert and I both kind of agree that it's likely to be no safety drivers. And like I said, you know, that's just like the overwhelming probability. That doesn't mean there's no chance that they'll have no safety drivers. And part of the unknowns there is, you know, they are doing this testing right now. They've talked about the fact that they have whatever, I can't remember the number of miles, but like 150,000 miles or something like that on this, and a few, like 1500 rides or something, whatever those numbers were. And they're going to be continuing to ramp up the rides that they're doing with this internal test fleet. And if something happens, you know, we've still got a whole month left. It's not impossible for some sort of intervention to happen between now and June 1st in that causes them to do a reevaluation of their plans. So that's going to be, and they're not going to tell us, you know, what is happening there. But the other thing that I would say is they've got enough miles under their belt to at least have an idea of what the safety should look like. And the fact that they're moving forward with these plans tells you that the data that they've seen on the miles that they have so far is probably pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think at that point, and this is, I kind of want to talk stock a little bit too, because I think it's going to be an interesting thing to watch, because this is something the company has been working towards for God knows how long. I'm really curious to see how the lack of a safety driver impacts the sort of how the public views the story, like the broader market, the broader public. I think there's still very much this thing where most people don't think this is a thing that's going to happen. But a huge majority of people don't think this is a thing that's going to happen. Before we go into that, Hans and I are both investors in Tesla, so obviously, do your own research and all that good stuff.
None We're not biased at all, I promise.
At all. No, not even a little bit. We're actually the least biased people on the internet, okay, when it comes to Tesla. Definitely. That's a joke. I hope everybody gets it.
Huge shout out to the sponsor of our podcast today, Rebellionaire. They are a brand of Halter Ferguson Financial, and they are a great company for helping with risk management, trimming and adding for Tesla long-term investors, even some help with covered calls. They are a longtime supporter of the Tesla community, and we appreciate their support of this podcast.
Yeah, these guys have been super familiar with the Tesla story specifically. They've been doing some unique research analysis of the company. They've done road trips on FSD, full self-driving with the cars. They've tracked the energy sector in a very close, innovative way. And we know a lot of you that watch this podcast and this channel are huge Tesla fans and also Tesla investors. Oftentimes when you talk to a financial advisor, usually you get the cold shoulder because it might be too risky. Whereas Rebellionaire actually embraces that type of thought process and that type of investment strategy, understand it deeply. And so if you're interested in checking them out, we have a link for them in the description and in the comment section below. You can go to rebellionaire.com/Farzad, rebellionaire.com/Farzad, and then they'll know we sent you. And now back to the podcast. What it is not a joke, though, is that Matt is the ugliest person I've ever met. Okay, so let me show this poll because I think this is very interesting. So this is my audience. That's okay. Before I do that, so it's been about 5 minutes. There's about 144 votes in, 178 votes. That's going to get us pretty close to where we're going to be. And my audience on X is predominantly pro Elon, pro Tesla. Okay, now I might not have the biggest subset of like investors or people that follow this as closely as maybe other folks on the platform, but curious to see. So there's three really options with a safety driver. So the question was, Tesla will launch Robotaxi in June in Austin. You can't cheat. You can't look at the poll on X. Okay. Tesla will launch Robotaxi in June in Austin with a safety driver is one option. Without a safety driver is another option. And then won't launch in June is the third option. And then see results is the fourth one. So What's your guess on how that breaks out?
My guess is with a safety driver is the most likely, followed by without a safety driver, followed by won't launch in June.
How big of a gap do you think there is between with and without?
20 points.
Ready? So 40% with a safety driver, 43% without a safety driver. So pretty close.
Pleasantly surprised. I got them wrong. So I thought with a safety driver would have more.
Oh. It just jumped up a little bit. 306 votes.
Hey, good. So people are, I don't know if that's good news or bad news. It means people are agreeing with me on X, which is good for confidence that it's going to happen. I don't know if it's good for stock price. You know, it's nice to have some surprise upside.
Yeah, but the people that follow the story closely are still kind of in a toss-up scenario. And so, like the people that don't follow the story closely that maybe are waiting to jump into the stock, which could drive prices up once they see this actually come to fruition, there would be closer aligned with the safety driver camp than without the safety driver camp, right? Because then the narrative can shift. Then the narrative can become, wow, Tesla is actually like Waymo. Because, you know, because like you said earlier, it's like, well, you know, Waymo doesn't have a safety driver. Like they're just driving around. But if Tesla, all of a sudden, you're whipping around Austin and then you're seeing all these like Teslas without a, like, think about that for a hot second. You're going to see all these Teslas, unless they're tinted to the gills, and a lot of Model Ys and 3s aren't. A lot of them are actually in Texas, but you can still see through the cabin for most people. And all of a sudden, the same car you've been seeing everywhere, like the best-selling car in the world, all of a sudden doesn't even have a driver. What kind of message does that send? And will people actually understand how fundamental that thing is? You know, I made a post on X a couple of days ago where I was like, Waymo has 1,000 cars in their fleet and Tesla makes 1,000 cars every 5 hours. And of course, these people that, you know, anti-Elon, anti-Tesla, sort of, you know, I am a cultist, et cetera, all over me. But like the inevitability of the Model Y not having a driver in the streets directly points to that fact. Directly points to that fact that the best-selling car in the world will not have a driver behind it, right? What kind of message is that going to send?
That's huge. And especially, you know, if you tack on whatever the growth rate is going to be, you know, if we go from 10 to 20 cars to 1,000 cars anywhere inside of the end of the year.
Yeah.
The growth rate of that, like you have Waymo's line of expansion of their fleet that goes like this. And then you plot the Tesla line against it. And it's like,
yeah.
And you know, like that's just easy math and numbers that literally every person on Wall Street can do. It's like, oh, I guess maybe Tesla's going to grow their fleet faster than Waymo. Maybe they're going to be able to earn more money because they're going to have a bigger fleet. Like, it's not going to take that long for that to just become an undeniable mathematical certainty, as long as we don't have crazy safety. You know, that's what people are betting, that the Waymo is going to be safer. It's going to have more, you know, it's going to have fewer incidents per mile, and that the Tesla approach is going to be more dangerous because they don't have the LiDAR. And if the data proves them otherwise, that gap in expectations is the opportunity for Tesla investors.
Yeah. Now the question becomes, how much of that is already priced in into the stock?
Definitely some.
I think a lot. I think a lot of that is priced in. I think we wouldn't have seen the sort of strength in the stock from the earnings report unless the market was confident that robotaxi was in the near future. That's the way
I read it. It's interesting because it, you know, I would say probably true, but the up and down recently seems to be very tied to macro, which whether robotaxi works or not, and the earnings potential of robotaxi is pretty independent of tariffs. And so you wouldn't think that tariffs would move Tesla stock on that basis, but I do think it moves the stock on the auto business a lot. There's definitely at least a large portion of the stock price that is still tied to the auto business, and that's the part that's going up and down with tariff news. And then, yeah, I think there is another part of the business that is just this option call on don't bet against Elon, going after this incredibly huge TAM that Waymo has proven is possible and it exists, but they haven't even begun to tap the market for.
Yeah. The trailblazer should be given all the credit in the world. With the Waymo team, like it cannot be overstated just how difficult of a thing they've done. You know, I mean, it's like unbelievable. Like the engineers there should be extremely proud of themselves,
especially when they picked like such a hard way to do it.
Yeah, hard way to do it, hard space to do it in, regulatory nightmare, and they still felt like this was good for the world, and it's fantastic. I mean, it really is fantastic. But the scale issue is going to be such a big problem for them. It's going to. It's only a problem because of Tesla. That's the reality. You know, now the counter argument is, well, the TAM is so big that Waymo is going to win as well. This is not, even if Waymo wins 10% of the miles, they still win. You know,
it will be really tough for them because they've got a lot of, you know, uphill battles to climb. I think in order for them to be able to maintain their ability to compete, they have to switch to a full end-to-end neural network approach instantaneously. And they, at the very least, have to change, you know, their software stack to be much more vision-based than LiDAR-based. Maybe they can still rely on some LiDAR, you know, I don't know, but that's going to be tough, especially when you look at edge cases. And so they've got to solve that problem from a software architecture and a hardware architecture standpoint. And then how do you like produce sufficient numbers of cars at high volume and low enough cost to be able to compete against someone like Tesla? I think that all of those things are very, very difficult for Waymo and potentially much easier for other industry participants.
I think the neural net question is almost second to a different approach they have to take. I think Waymo has to super specialize. I think they need to get into the game of like offering very niche, unique use cases for taking people from point A to point B, because no one else is going to be able to compete with Tesla's cost. It's just not going to happen. You know, I mean, you can say whatever you want. It's just not going to happen. I'd say that from a cost perspective, with the AI stack that they've built, the downside was it takes 8 to 10 years of Elon missing timelines to get this thing on the road. The plus side is that you can make millions per year once you get there. That's the plus side, at like a very low cost. relative to everybody else. Okay. So for Waymo, it's going to be impossible for you to compete with that because you don't own the manufacturing and the supply chain.
You know, the other benefit to that, as far as Elon's strategy, is that, you know, they have built this huge fleet of vehicles that already exist that are capable of full self-driving once the software is done. And so you like pre-populate the roads with these future potential robo-taxis that are already exist. They're already out there. They're already all over the United States and all over the world. And then you can turn them on at one point, and all of a sudden now they can go start earning autonomous ride hail revenues, or they can earn, you know, full self-driving personal chauffeur revenues if you don't want them to participate in some public ride hail network. You know, either way, their ability to earn goes up by, you know, an order of magnitude.
Yeah. I think the fun thing we've done for the last few years, and it's so crazy that we're here, it's been tracking progress. It was less about, and this is where the other side of the argument gets stuck. It's like, well, they haven't done it. They don't have a self-driving car. It's like, brother, it's about the line. It's about the derivative. It's about the acceleration. It's about the direction. That's what you want. That's what you're trying to follow here, because the underlying technology allows for scale. The underlying technology allows for low cost. If the technology is telling you that it's going to get there, the company that has the underlying system to put that technology everywhere, that's the winner. It's not the person who has a self-driving car on the road.
Yeah, saying that it's not going to work is the same as going back to, you know, 1995 and saying that you're never going to be able to stream video on the internet because you've never been able to do that before. It's like, no, motherfucker. Like, bits are getting cheaper to transmit. Network capacity is getting more. Like, every single forcing function in the underlying technology of chips, of networking, of all these things, like all of those graphs are up and to the right, like you said.
Yeah.
And so eventually, it's not like, yes, maybe those things are hard to do today. Maybe they cost too much today. But all you have to do is look at where these things are trending. You're like, oh yeah, in the year 2000, that's going to get a lot easier if we just continue on current trends. And then poof, like, you know, eventually you get something like Amazon Web Services, which can host the vast majority of all the data in the world and, you know, transmit video and all. Like, you can get a YouTube service. You can get all these things. Like, those things were always going to happen once you were on some of those technology curves that were just playing out like gravity, like Tony Seba says. And, you know, the growth in intelligence of AI technology has been consistent and steady for the last several years. And, you know, this is the thing that I think Elon saw post AlexNet back in 2012, when the first AI system was able to recognize cats at a superhuman levels in images. It's like, oh, that's a different kind of thing. And I don't know how long it's going to take from here to there, but eventually we're going to be able to apply so many more transistors to this problem, and our software is going to get so much better that same capability is not only going to be able to recognize cats, it's also going to be able to drive cars.
Yeah.
And that is a reality. And the question is not, is that possible? It's, you know, is that possible in June of 2025? That's the only question. And the fact that no one else is all in on this specific approach tells you that no one else is really thinking about the problem from first principles. Like, it is guaranteed that AI is going to be able to drive cars with neural nets and cameras. Now, you can quibble about, you know, are the hardware 3 cameras good enough? Are the hardware 4 cameras good enough? Is the coverage good enough? Is the hardware 4 computer good enough? You know, all those things, maybe there are questions.
But 95% of the cost is solved for.
Yes. And so even if you say, okay, they can't do it in this generation, it takes them to AI 5 computers and cameras, it's still going to happen. Like, there's no question that it's going to happen. And no one else is like, Toyota or Waymo or no other company is putting millions of computers into their cars with the cameras needed to be able to drive purely AI and vision. And so no one else is on the path. And yeah. That's, you know, that's the reality of the situation as far as getting, you know, getting the technology to work and then getting it to work at scale. That, yeah, you can get something that works like Waymo has earlier potentially. And if you think that you can get network effects by being the first to market, great, but you still got to scale. And that's the thing that you know, if you make it too expensive, if you use too much, you know, if you use too many crutches on the way to solving the problem, then your solution doesn't scale. And if it costs you 10 times, you know, if your Waymo car costs 10 times the amount as the Tesla or 5 times or 4 times, then all Tesla has to do is, you know, like they spend $1 and you have to spend 4. And so they just start spending faster and accelerate your losses if you try to compete with them. And it's just
it's gonna be brutal.
An economic forcing function towards domination by whatever company can deploy the best quality, pure AI and vision driving solution as widely as possible.
Couple variables that I'm very interested in is the size that they're going to serve in Austin. Because there's, I don't think there's, last thing I've checked is that there's no details. Like when they say Austin, what does that mean? Does that mean down? Does that mean like Cesar Chavez to 10th? Does that mean like all the way up to UT and down to South Austin? Does it include the suburbs? Does it include like, you know, Cedar Park? And does it include Pflugerville and Kyle Buda and all these different places? Does it go all the way out to Bastrop? Does it go to Georgetown? Right? Like that's the big thing. And here's the deal: like the size of that. Of that geography, that's, to me, that's the signal that says that Tesla has figured it out. Now, do we know if the Waymo boundaries are defined by Waymo or is it defined by the city of Austin? Do we know that?
I don't know.
Let me ask Brock real quick.
Where they can or cannot go. But I do agree with your overall point, and it'll probably start out small. You know, if you've only got 10 to 20 cars, then you probably can't operate in a super huge area, but as that grows, you know, the number of cars grows and the amount of area can grow. And this is, you know, an interesting point that doesn't get talked about very often is sorry that if you have
Waymo sets the boundaries, not
Waymo Austin. Sets the boundaries. Okay, good. And the reason I say good is because that means that Tesla will be able to expand the boundaries that they operate in without having to interface with the city of Austin.
If the thesis is correct, that AI is going to work. Yeah.
So if you think about, you know, if it's true that we can get to cost to operate that is significantly below Uber's cost to operate, then one of the immediate effects of that is that you can expand the coverage area of your robo-taxi network past the boundaries that Uber will cover. And so, like, a lot of times it's hard to, you have to wait forever to get picked up if you're way out in the suburbs or somewhere and you want to go to downtown because there's not that many drivers who want to be out that far because there's not that many riders. And, you know, that makes sense for that Uber driver. But as you scale up this autonomous robo-taxi that doesn't have a driver and it costs a lot less, and they, you know, first they'll saturate, you know, the market where the most rides are, but then they'll continue to grow and expand, and eventually you'll have way more coverage. And then if you think about that from a network effects perspective, man, do you want to use Uber where it's hard and you got to wait when you're not close to city center? Or do you want to use the network that you can always get a robo-taxi within under 5 minutes pickup time, even if you're not downtown? Like, that's a huge win. Oh, and it costs less. Oh, and you don't have a stinky driver in the front seat who hasn't put on deodorant in the past 7 days. And, you know, the list of things goes on and on and on.
That's so true. Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be a fascinating thing to track. And I think that's something I think a lot of people maybe are not paying attention to, is not being discussed. I think like it would be the best case scenario. Like if we talk through best case scenario for this rollout, is they go on June 1st. There's no driver behind the wheel and the service area is bigger than Waymo's. If those three things are true, I think that the narrative shifts immediately. I think that's going to be one would think that's a very obvious thing for analysts and for people to pick up on, is that Tesla's first foray into, you know, people call true self-driving is better than the player that's been doing it forever. So we'll see if that's the case. The worst case scenario is they miss June completely. And then the second worst case scenario is they launch in June, they have a safety driver, and the service area is smaller than or the same size as Waymo. I do think, though, do we know? So Elon said they have a bunch of safety drivers, a bunch of cars driving around Austin, all over the place. Do we know where?
I assume that they are driving people to and from the factory, but no, I...
But like where? You know, because... I mean, if I pull up a map of Austin Metro, right, you've got, I'm not going to share my screen because, you know, my little thing was going to come up here. So I'll just keep it to myself. Let's see. Because I know like a lot of people, so the factory is southeast of the city. That's where the airport's at. And the factory is very close by. You can actually see it from the satellite so easy. Kind of freaking crazy, the factory. Unbelievable. So it's off of 130, by the way, one of the fastest highways in the United States, in case for people that are not familiar. I think the speed limit is 85 or 80. I think it's 85.
I think it is 85. It's fast.
So fast. But I know there's a lot of people that work at the factory that live, east of the factory. So in places like Garfield, in places like Bastrop, Bastrop's all the way out there. There are people that live in Manor, which is like more like East Austin, call it like. Very, very East Austin is off of 290. You got people that live in Pflugerville, Round Rock, that's more north. Cedar Park is northwest. Collin Buda in South Austin, so on and so forth. Now, if I pull up a Waymo Austin map, let's see where they offer rides. Man, why is that such a Rolez? My goodness. Okay. Yeah, so it's not very big, huh? What they offer. Go ahead and pull this up. Where you can go. Sorry, give me 1 second. Dude, my voice is messed up. I'm gonna have to cancel with Larry. Like, struggling to talk. Jeez. Okay. Can you see my screen?
Yep.
Okay. So you got Austin. So here you got the lake. So this kind of like divides North Austin and South Austin, or like downtown Austin and South Austin. So it's definitely not going to go anywhere close to the suburbs. UT Austin's here. This is sort of North Austin. So it does cover quite a bit of the city, like the city proper. But it doesn't go much past outside of the boundaries of the city of Austin. So it doesn't go into a lot of different places where people would live traditionally in the area. I think if Tesla can somehow figure out how to include a couple suburbs in there, I wonder if, so it, are there regulations in Texas? Does Austin have its own regulation, or is it Texas led the regulation in the state for self-driving? So
I wish I knew more on that question. Let's ask Brock. That is a good question.
So for self-driving vehicles, who drives the regulation? The cities or the state in Texas?
So while you're looking at that, one interesting observation for people who don't live in Texas is Texas can be a very interesting town interesting state from a regulatory standpoint. You know, we've got the auto dealership lobby has strong influence, and that's one of the reasons why Tesla still isn't legally allowed to sell vehicles directly in the state of Texas. But that's because there is an entrenched interest there. The same has been true for like the oil industry kind of gets a lot of special treatment. The dealerships get special treatment. There's a lot of strange regulations around tobacco and alcohol in Texas as well. So, you know, on the one hand, that's negative. On the other hand, what you can realize is that they do cater to the large interests of their base.
Oh yeah.
Of large industry. And when it comes to autonomous driving, this actually does favor Tesla, that Tesla will probably be given a large voice in shaping the regulation in the state of Texas and in individual cities as well for autonomous vehicles and autonomous ride hail.
So here's a very interesting thing from Grok. In Texas, the state drives the regulation of self-driving vehicles, not cities. Texas Senate Bill 2205, passed in 2017, grants the state exclusive authority over autonomous vehicle regulations. This law prohibits cities, including Austin, from imposing local rules, restrictions, or boundaries on AV operations. The Texas Department of Motor Vehicles, and other state agencies oversee compliance, safety standards, and reporting requirements for AV companies. Cities can collaborate with AV operators like Waymo to share local transportation data or address safety concerns, but they lack the power to regulate or set boundaries. This state-level control ensures uniform rules across Texas, preventing a patchwork of municipal regulations. That's a big deal. That's a huge deal.
Yep.
That's a really big deal, because that's going to dramatically open up, to your point, how useful this service is, right? Like that,
yeah,
that
and how much it can scale. Like even if they don't scale to any other states in the near future, like there's a lot of big cities in Texas that they can scale this service to. You know, not only is there like Austin is the smallest of the big cities in Texas. And so, you know, the fact that they're starting there really is just a fact, are associated with the fact that they have the factory there and their workforce is there. And so that makes a whole lot of sense. But DFW is obviously a huge metro area. Houston, San Antonio, like all of these cities are very large. And if they can have a consistent regulatory framework among all of those cities, like that's a lot of playground to really debug this system and get it ready for prime time to then scale to the rest of the nation.
Yeah. Austin to San Antonio, there's nothing in the regulation that says that Tesla can't do that. It just comes down to capability.
And that's basically just like one huge, long, developed strip of...
Yeah, just 35
interstate. Hellhole. Yeah. Yes. It's awful.
Hate 35 so much. God. It's the second worst highway that I've ever experienced, second only to 22 in the Lehigh Valley area in PA. Route 22, it connects sort of like Easton, Bethlehem, Allentown. Anyone from that area, shout out the Lehigh Valley. 610-484 area codes. The worst. That thing has been under construction for 1,000 years. Literally, I've never seen construction move slower than in Pennsylvania. Anyway, don't get me. Okay.
I'm sure LA is up there.
Could be.
Being close to just as bad. And I don't even want to know what it's like in New York. But
yeah. It's pretty bad. New York is, they have... we would frequent the city often. And the one thing that we always realize about those areas is that some potholes, you just know where they are because they never get fixed. Like for some reason, like you have forever potholes in these areas from like all the snow and ice and shit. Like they don't, like you have forever potholes. Like, oh, that's the pothole by Fifth or whatever. Anyway. Fascinating stuff. So the size of the metro area and how far into the boundaries they go, like how far they shoot the boundaries, like if they launch with Georgetown to Austin or like Cedar Park to Austin, Bastrop to Austin, that's going to be a huge deal.
And I don't expect that area to be super huge on launch day, but I do expect it to expand quickly. You know, as the fleet expands, I expect it to expand quickly. And so that's what I've said that I'm really looking for as the leading indicators that are going to kind of give you an idea of how long is this going to take. It's the growth in fully autonomous, unsupervised, not just FSD miles and FSD supervised miles, but FSD unsupervised miles. So how many unsupervised miles do we have? And then what's the total square miles that are covered by unsupervised operation? Those two things will tell you very early on what is the level that we're on. And then if you track those things and then you're starting to see bends in the curves of those lines, like if those don't end up being lines but curves, then you're in really exciting territory.
And it's like the Tesla story has always been a story of derivatives. It's always been a story of acceleration, a story of like pace of improvement, pace of innovation. In the same way that the neural nets, we were all tracking to see how much that it would get faster, that would get better faster, you know? So we've seen that very obviously and very clearly for people that have used the vehicles. Now we need to see the same exact thing, exactly to your point, to the geography of the node driver behind the steering wheel and pedal performance. And so they're going to start, like you said, small. You know, I'm here getting very excited about them potentially launching with a Georgetown to downtown Austin type thing, or, you know, whatever, like a metro, Austin metro thing. Probably unrealistic to do. Although, you know, what's funny, though, is I'll tell you that in my cars, FSD in the suburbs is such a piece of cake. I mean, it's I don't know what the water is like in Austin, but those motherfuckers are insane. I've never seen more distracted / drunk drivers in my life than in Austin. It's insane. Like, what is it over there? You know, it's like, too many good brew pubs. I just got with that, man. That's amazing. I don't know if it's like the road system. It's just people don't know how to drive. It's not even that weird. It's just people literally don't know how to drive. And you got 35 going right through the city. So it's like people are getting off the road and they're pissed off with being on 35. Anyway, but like the suburbs, they're very easy for FSD. I mean, on my Model Y in the Cybertruck, it's a piece of cake. And I record videos with my cars being in FSD, all in FSD all the time. And it's like safety. Why am I blanking on this word right now? When you take over. When you take over.
Oh, safety critical interventions.
Oh my God, interventions. Yeah. They don't exist. They just simply don't exist. I can't remember the last time I had a safety critical intervention. I can't remember the last time I had a safety critical intervention even more in the suburb area, you know? So in theory, that would be easier for them to execute against. But who knows? I could be wrong. So, okay. Super exciting. We're going to track this extremely closely, Hans and I. Very closely. Yeah.
Just quick point that I want to add, you know, the fact that we are going straight to a ride hail network before we have even released unsupervised FSD to customers. Also, like if you just step back and look at it from the 1,000-foot view strategically, that means that the team, not just Elon, is very confident about the progress of the technology and that they are going full send on the thing that accelerates the transition to sustainable transport the fastest, simultaneously will make them the most money the fastest. Yeah. Like, you know, there's definitely an intermediate path that they could have taken to just try and drive up FSD take rate on personal vehicles, you know, reducing the amount of time that you have to spend monitoring the car, like monetizing. But that would have been, you know, a much more conservative approach to roll out and monetize the software. So the fact that they haven't gone that direction and they're going straight towards an autonomous ride hail platform that is launching in June before even customers have FSD unsupervised in their car, like that just shows you that they are aggressive, pedal to the metal, moving forward, shooting for the stars. And, you know, I like to see the confidence.
Yeah. And then you contrast that with a company like Apple that has, I learned this from Amit's stream earlier today. By the way, shout out Amit. Dude, he is a rock star. I love his coverage. I really do. He does such a good job covering everything. Apple has done nearly $1 trillion in buybacks. What are you fucking kidding me? Apple was like in prime position to just win everything tech. And it just really highlights how incredibly important having a person at the front leading the vision and leading the direction, how incredibly important that is for a company to be able to survive into the future. It's unbelievable.
It does cause you to question, like, what would Apple have been like if Steve Jobs hadn't died? And what would the entire landscape of technology look like?
They would have bought Tesla.
I don't know. I think that Steve would have considered it. I don't know if Steve and Elon could have gotten along together, though. Like, can you imagine the two of those people working together?
Honestly, I think that's impossible. Literally, the universe would collapse onto itself. Time would go backwards. So we'll go back to the Big Bang, and then everything just deletes itself. You know?
This is the great filter. And yeah, any time that Steve Jobs and Elon get too close together, civilization implodes.
Those two could not exist in the same timeline at their prime. It would be impossible. It would literally create, like, World War III would start, you know, with those two alive. I think I think what would have happened is, it's no secret that Elon hates being CEO of Tesla. I mean, he's very open, you know, and sometimes Elon likes to sort of, like, you know, he likes to let people know how hard it is sometimes. You know, I completely appreciate that because it's very difficult. But you could see that it's probably his least favorite job is to be CEO of Tesla, but he feels like he has to do it because he has to do it. I think if he had a chance, like his comment is always like, I would give up the CEO role at Tesla in a heartbeat if I had somebody that I felt could do it better than I could. Who else better than Steve Jobs?
Yeah.
Who else better than Steve Jobs?
I mean, Steve definitely understood. They're so different in so many ways, but he definitely understood the importance of the product and the product first engineering approach. And then the ability of, you know, some of these technologies, regardless of whether he would have been involved in, like, Tesla, his ability to navigate Apple through this phase of disruption with AI.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think there's anyone with, you know, more than 10 IQ points who doesn't think that Steve Jobs would do a much better job of incorporating AI into the full suite of Apple products than Tim Cook. Like, you know, Tim Cook is great at a lot of things, and, you know, supply chain is incredibly difficult and incredibly important. And
he's the GOAT supply chain executive, the GOAT.
Yeah. And, but that only gets you so far in a world where now the entire landscape of the tech industry has shifted, and now you need to re-engineer all of your products from the ground up for a new world. And that's just not Tim Cook.
I think Apple's best bet for survival now is, like, to become a Disney type, or a Merrill Lynch, or a, like, a cornerstone of American industry that will never go away under any circumstance. That is Apple's best bet. It's like, just permeate society so much that people not using your product literally means that they are missing out on something that's core to being in America, let's say, or just core of, like, using one of their products. But that also means that you have to be so unbelievably constrained and restrained, and you have to microanalyze the smallest tiny things, and taking risks becomes the worst thing you can do. That's Apple's only hope for long-term survival. But that is a 5 to 7 PE boring snooze fest. And that's maybe when I'm 80, I'll move my money into Apple. But until then, you know, it's like, but listen, they did. I mean, I'm on a MacBook Pro. I have an Apple iPhone. I have my AirPods on. Like, it's the thesis proves out. It's just, there's just, what could have been? What could have been?
Yeah. I mean, the question isn't, you know, do they make some of the greatest pre-AI tech hardware products with the best ecosystem lock-in ever? Yes, but everything is shifting rapidly with AI and their ability to execute on bringing any of that into the ecosystem in a meaningful way just remains to be seen. And the early indications are not good, and like, Tim Cook's ability to launch meaningful new products, whether hardware or software, is not great.
The watch and the AirPods are probably the best ones. The
only positives, yeah.
Yeah, and then the rest, the Vision Pro, the maps, the AI thing, the Beats by Dre.
I mean, if you want to sit like their Apple Silicon has done really well. So I don't know if you want to call a thing.
I would. I mean, it's changed my workflow completely.
Yeah. And so that their technical strength there is cool. But then their ability to translate that into meaningful software.
Yeah. Leaves like a lot to be desired.
It just doesn't seem like iOS. Anything, whether you know Mac OS, iOS, any of that stuff has really changed in any significant way in, I don't know,
yeah,
6-7 years.
And the next one they're going to be releasing, it's going to be completely built on AI. So God help us all, because if they bungle that up, that's how you destroy your walled garden.
Oh yeah. Yep. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons it's so hard, because they have such a incredibly valuable walled garden. And you know, if you mess that up, then the value of all the stuff that you've worked so hard to create. Yeah. So that's why it takes longer. And, you know, obviously I think they recognize these challenges and constraints. Yeah. Hopefully they can execute. I would definitely love to be able to continue using all the products that I own today for all the AI use cases that are coming in a valuable way. Even if they take longer to deliver that, because it is hard to get it integrated into the ecosystem, like that's okay, as long as they execute and they actually make it happen and they don't crash the ecosystem, like you said, it's just hard.
Yeah, but like what a gigantic door that has been opened for a competitor now. Like, when's the last time you could say a competitor can come in and upend Apple as a go-to place for computing? Like, and the vector they use, like the variable they're going to have to capitalize on, is just building everything on neural nets. Like, it's an AI platform. It has to be driven by agents. Like, you open your computer and then you just say, or whatever, you open the thing, it's like, hey, I'm trying to get this done today. Can you help me? And it just does it. It just shows up on your screen. You know, hey, I need to shop, I need to place an order for, on Whole Foods. I need these items. Can you have it delivered to me by 2? Sure, no problem. It just shows up. You don't have to go to the website. You don't have to go pick the products. It already knows what you want, right? Like, by and large. And if you have a fridge that has vision technology that can analyze your fridge and it sees what you're missing, what you like to eat, it talks to the thing, and then the thing just gets what you want, you know? And then if you have a bot in your house, like a cleaning bot, you know, they all talk to each other. Like, you know, you're going to cook around this time. Like, it's just everything's connected. Your life just happens, you know? Yep. That's where Apple needs to capitalize. And it feels like they're so unbelievably not equipped for that, you know?
Yeah.
We'll see. I could be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. I really hope I'm wrong.
The question, they're working really hard on this. And the question is, can they actually deliver? And I would say at least... So if you look at the Apple car example, that's a example that would indicate, no, they can't execute. Like, it's a really big, ambitious project. It's super hard. Can they bring it to reality, ship it to customers?
Yeah.
No, they couldn't. But this is a lot more in their wheelhouse, at least, than a car. So maybe in this area they can. And maybe trying to do the car was a distraction from being able to do this thing that they need to focus on more.
Yeah.
And maybe they can execute. But the I always, you know, the reason that I am so critical of Tim Cook or Sundar Pichai also, for example, is that it takes a special type of visionary leader, like an Elon Musk, like a Steve Jobs, like a Palmer Luckey, like an Alex Karp, like a Jensen Huang, like these, the amount of vision about what the future is going to look like, and then conviction, and then like 360 degree awareness of your company and the landscape of the technology and all of these different factors in order to bring new things into existence like that. And I just like, that's where I don't see that in Tim Cook. I don't see that in Sundar Pichai. If Google is going to be able to navigate some of their challenges, you know, I think it's really going to have to come from Larry and Sergey more than anything else. And maybe they can, you know, maybe they can drive that and Sundar can kind of manage it. But you know, like it needs founder mode. And yeah. I just don't like Tim Cook is not founder mode CEO, and neither like Satya is a great example of someone who's not the actual founder of Microsoft, but he is definitely founder mode CEO.
He's a beast.
He is a beast. And so, yeah, like I think Apple needs, and Google both could really use a Satya type character for this next decade of disruptive innovation and change.
You want to hear my prediction? And we'll leave it with this. I'm probably going to be wrong, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think he pushes Sam out by the end of the year at OpenAI.
By end of the year? So I think the most ironic outcome being the most likely where Elon buys OpenAI is actually... There's significant possibility there. But man, by the end of the year, that sure is an aggressive timeline on the under.
Completely going off of gut feel. Gut feel, some of the posts coming out from there, the fact that Microsoft is looking to add Grok to their foundation stuff, like you know, and it's very smart for Microsoft to bring in a competitor to compete with its own, you know, with the thing that they've also piggybacked on, which is OpenAI. I just feel
they definitely need the leverage. They need to, you know, not be dependent on OpenAI fully. Correct. So they need to do that. They probably also need to plan to host the Llama stuff and, you know, and really Azure. I think you're going to see this increasingly, that all of the cloud AI hyperscalers are going to be just a la carte, like all the proprietary models from them plus all the open source, like everyone just as whatever you want to do here, like our GPUs or our ASICs, whatever, you know, whether it's Amazon and their Graviton or Trainium or any of this stuff, or NVIDIA hardware, like we just want you to use our friggin' chips to produce some dang tokens. And we don't care what the model is that's doing it. We're going to try and make that as easy for you as possible.
Yeah. And it's cost effective for both of us.
Yep.
Yeah. And OpenAI is not that at all.
No.
That's their biggest issue. Is like, do they have the bleeding edge model? Sure. Is it significantly better than everyone else's? Jury's still out. Is it significantly more expensive than anyone else's? Oh yeah.
Yep.
Oh yeah. And you're going to start running into massive diminishing returns when you run that model, because it's like,
I mean, there's always, so, you know, the area of technology is so important that I think there are going to be a significant number of users who will always have to use it because it is the most, like, you need to know what the future is going to look like. And if you get better insight into what the future is going to look like by using OpenAI stuff, then maybe that gives you a leg up in your product development stuff. That doesn't mean that you're going to plan to use OpenAI stuff in production when you're actually trying to deliver value-added services to your customers. So I think there's definitely a niche for that use case. I just don't know that niche is the one where most of the money and profits end up materializing.
What are the chances that Trump used OpenAI's frontier model to come up with a strategy for the tariff negotiation?
Mm-hmm.
Zero. That dude's all gut feel. The whole thing is just gut. He's a big old gut, 224 pounds, which I don't buy at all. Going out there, just fucking wheeling and dealing, making shit happen. We'll see. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm listening to some pretty smart people trying to figure it out. But
he's surrounding himself with the right people. I mean, I really do think, I mean, some of them like Navarro, like to me, come across as literal idiots to me. But
yeah, I view Navarro as this administration's version of John Bolton. You know, he said he kept John Bolton around because, you know, it made other people
uncomfortable,
scared. Yeah, of what might happen. And
Elon is kind of that in a lot of ways too, if you really think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So. I think it's just interesting to watch all of it play out. I do think he's toying with some very important and very complicated systems. And I think there's a lot of tail risk attached to that is scary, and things could definitely go south, but at least he's trying.
I tell you what though, that mineral deal in Ukraine though, I think that's a big deal. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think
hopefully we'll see more trade negotiation deals coming, getting announced in the not too distant future.
For sure. Okay. Hi, everybody. And recording.